This is a class I'm going to use, I think, on Friday night as part of the retreat after the meet and greet and a little bit of music. I thought this might be a good introduction for people to the Bhagavad Gita. And it's based on a book by Purushottam Das called Sri Krishna's Names in the Bhagavad Gita. In the Bhagavad Gita, there are 41 different names by which Arjuna addresses Krishna. And I haven't gone through them all. I basically just went through the first chapter, in which there are about 8 and 9, but this could be a series. But it's interesting because just in following the different names of Krishna, you underline the basic points of the Bhagavad Gita, and it gives a good pretext, a good basis for telling the story and setting the scene of the Gita. So, of course, in the first scene, it's actually just first chapter of the Gita is called by Prabhupada setting the scene. So, it is stated that God has many, many names. We're ordinary parts and parcels of the Lord. We're infinitesimal sparks coming from the infinite Lord. And as such, we're persons and we're active. And the more active we are, the more things we do, successes we have, failures we run against, we get names. You know, if you fail, someone might call you a loser. So in addition to the names you were born with, first name, middle name, last name, you got another name called loser, you know. If you're on a championship baseball or football team, people may call you champ, so there you've got another name. Your girlfriend might have a name for you, a pet name. So we start with names and we accumulate names, for better or for worse, throughout our life. So the Supreme Person from whom we come, he's unlimitedly active, and his pastimes are wonderful and super excellent. So he has many, many names. And those names, each of his name, Prabhupada actually said in one lecture, God has no name. Personally has no name. But he gets names because of his pastimes, because of the things that he does and the people with whom he associates. Like Urukrama means who performs wonderful heroic activities. Parthasarathi, who drove the chariot of Arjuna. Yashoda Nandana, who gives pleasure to Mother Yashoda. So you could say he doesn't have a name, but he has hundreds of millions of names because he has all kinds of pastimes and he has all kinds of different variegated relationships with his many, many devotees. So the Lord displays wonderful variety of spiritual bodies, pastimes, and qualities, and he has names according to those qualities, pastimes, and characteristics. In the Mahabharata, Bhishma, the great warrior and also devotee, he lists 1,000 names of Vishnu. I know every culture has a number of names for the Lord. In Muslim culture, there are the 99 names of God. In the Old Testament, Christianity, there are about 50, 60 different names of God. I don't think any other culture has 1,000 names of God. And so in the Mahabharata, Bhishma, in giving these names of God, which have been passed down for the last 5,000 years, many people in India get up early in the morning, they take their shower, and they sit with their family in front of their home altars, and without even referring to the book, they start chanting, Vishnam, Vishnam, Vishadkaro, Bhuta, Bhavi, Bhavat, Bhuta, Brit, Bhuta, Brit, Bhutatma, Bhuta, Bhavam, Nam, Bhutatma, Paramatma, Cha, Muktanam, Paramamgi, Avya, Purusha, Chetura, Chetra, Gnur, Chara, Eva, Cha. That's two verses, and there are 105 more. And they chant them more often than not from memory. So the result of this, and the reason they do that, is also mentioned by Bhishma. He says, to be free from the miseries of this world, one should with full absorption glorify the 1,000 names of Vishnu. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, 5,000 years ago, Krishna in the guise of his own devotee, his business was just chanting the names of the Lord. Sometimes he would sing Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. Sometimes he would sing Yadavaya, Madhavaya, Keshavaya, Namaha. Full time, practically, his business was chanting the holy names of the Lord. His disciples, the six Goswamis, wrote hundreds and hundreds of books. But he only wrote 8 verses, and in those 8 verses is contained all of Vaishnava philosophy. And the second verse is Nam Namakari Bahuda Nija Sarva Shaktish. Nam Namakari Bahuda. He said, Lord, you have hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of names. And in each one of those names, you have invested your full potency. And there are no hard and fast rules for chanting these names. So anyone can chant the names under any circumstances and get the personal association for the Lord. Nija Sarva Shaktish. Shakti means power. Sarva means all. Lord Chaitanya doesn't say some of your power. Kuch Shaktish. He says Sarva Shaktish. All of your power is contained within these holy names. So there's no greater benediction to human society than the names of God. And God, in order to make himself accessible and to increase the chances that we're going to stumble across at least one of these names, he just throws them out there, you know, like it's like throwing tacks on a highway, you know. And the car's got to run over at least one of the tacks, you know. I mean, it's just practical. So Lord Chaitanya Krishna has thrown so many names out there and said there's no hard and fast rules for chanting them, and anyone you chant, and Nija Sarva Shaktish, and in each and every one of them, the full potency of the Lord is there. So he's making it very hard for us to elude him. So if someone's innocent, the chances are that they'll experiment with or be exposed to or be introduced to the chanting of the holy names by a sincere practitioner. The only way you can really avoid it, Lord Chaitanya has established such a wide net, is if you are consciously trying to avoid it. If you're consciously trying to avoid the chanting and the prasadam, then of course you'll be successful. But if you're neutral, then Lord Chaitanya intends to get you involved in this transcendental practice of associating with the Lord by chanting his holy names. Now, names arise because of basically three different causes. There are names according to the culture that we're born in. There are names according to the relationships that we have with people. And there are names according to social customs. Now, for instance, in India, a wife will never call her husband by her first name. She'll never call him by her first name. Sometimes they'll call him by his last name, or sometimes they'll call the wife Arya. Priya means one who is dedicated to higher principles. But there's a formality. There's a certain studied formality in the way that the wife addresses the husband. It's never by the first name. It's never familiar. But in the Western countries, because it's a different culture, you know, she calls him sweetheart, which is, you know, totally different. It's at the other end of the pole. So what is accepted in one culture would be rejected in another culture. What is rejected in one culture would be accepted in another culture. So according to the culture, different names are generated. According to the relationships that we have with one another, there are different names. There are certain names that we would not call our mother, for instance. A child doesn't refer to his mother as the wife of my father. That just doesn't do it. That's not in keeping with the mood, and that kind of communication would dampen the sweetness of the mother-son relationship. So according to relationships, like for instance, maybe you had a boyfriend, if you're female, who used to call him Shnuksham Puksham, or maybe you were called by Shnuksham Puksham. Now, your girlfriend can call you that, or your wife can call you that, but if another man calls you that, you're going to have a knockdown, drag-out fight, you know? So it's according to culture and according to gender, too. There are some things that a female can call a man, but if another man calls that man, then you get a totally different reaction. So cultures dictate different names and relations. And then social status. In India, there's a term, natiya, which means a poor man, and it's a disrespectful term. It's a demeaning term. If you're called a natiya, you're being put down. But if you're called a natalal, that's a respectful term. It's like in the Western cultures, you know, you call someone Doug or you call someone Mr. Smith, because Mr. Smith is wealthy, and so you put the Mr. there as an indication of terms of respect, and someone else you might just call Smith or Jones or Bill or, you know, something like that. Many of our names in the Western culture also came as a result of function. For instance, Smith, somewhere back in one's ancestor, there might have been a blacksmith. And if you examine a lot of different names, like Lisa's name, Proudlock. Now that's got to have a basis in some sort of a profession, you know. There's got to have been a vocation out of which that name was generated. So there are all kinds of names, and they arise for different purposes. Now the first name that Arjuna calls Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th verse of the first chapter, he calls him Madhava. Madhava means husband of the goddess of fortune. Now Sanjaya is narrating the Bhagavad Gita. He's sitting beside Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra is a blind king, It is Dhritarashtra's sons, the Kauravas, who oppose the Pandavas. And Dhritarashtra can't see, and so he's depending on Sanjaya to describe the events on the battlefield. To him, the battlefield has not yet begun. The Kauravas, the bad guys, outnumber the good guys by about 5-3. And Dhritarashtra's anxious to know what's going on. He says, how's it shaping up? You know, in other words, he's obviously partial to his sons, so he's saying, how's it going? Does it look like my sons are going to win? And so right away, Sanjaya answers to Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra says, how's it going? And right away, Sanjaya, who's no dummy, he has spiritual vision, spiritual insight, he says, Madhava and Pandava, he's answering Dhritarashtra, Madhava and Pandava, stationed on the great chariot drawn by white horses, sounded their transcendental conchs. Now right away, from the first answer that Sanjaya gives Dhritarashtra, we know that his sons don't have a chance. Because he's using this word for Krishna, Madhava. Madhava means husband of the goddess of fortune. So if the husband of the goddess of fortune is on your side, then you're going to have fortune on your side, aren't you? And if the goddess, if fortune is not on your side, then you're going to lose. So right away, just from the name of Krishna, just from the very first thing, just by describing Krishna, and he has so many names, but Sanjaya picks that name, Madhava, to send a message to Dhritarashtra, your sons don't have a chance. And all along, everybody's told Dhritarashtra, call it off, talk some sense into your sons, back down. Krishna is going to go on the Pandava side against your tyrannical son. And in that, if that's the case, your miscreant sons, they don't have a chance. So Sanjaya is Dhritarashtra's well-wisher, and perhaps by using this name Madhava, he's giving Dhritarashtra one more chance. You know, just send a messenger out. I mean, Dhritarashtra is the king, and if he puts his foot down, he can stop. He can order his sons not to fight. But that's his problem. He's wishy-washy. He wants his cake and eat it too. He knows that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He knows that righteousness is on the Pandava side. He knows his sons have acted improperly. And yet somehow or other he wishes for a good result. So what we talked about on Sunday. Intention does not determine destination. Direction determines destination. You know, Dhritarashtra, he doesn't understand this principle. Direction determines destination. The righteous win wars because they have righteousness on their side, and that righteousness is personified by Krishna. The righteousness get to a position of prosperity and contentment and glorification. The unrighteous achieve ill repute, notoriety, defeat, and destruction. But Dhritarashtra, he's thinking that as long as my intention is that everything ends up well, then that will determine the destination. But that's not right. It's the direction that determines the destination. It's not where your head takes you, it's where your feet are going. You know, your feet may be going to Spanish Fork, and your head's thinking, I'd like to be in Payson. But it's not what the intention of your head is, it's where your feet are going. So all the actions of the Kauravas, the conspiracies, the murder plots, all of them would indicate that they are in the direction of ultimate destruction. But their intentions are, they think that intentions are sufficient to get me to a certain destination. We gave the example before. Someone intends to retire with a comfortable nest egg for their retirement. But right now, I'm spending more than I make. I intend to save money, but my direction is that I'm spending more than I make, so my destination will not be to have a comfortable nest egg, because I'm in a different direction. I intend to have my children around me when I'm old, when I'm a grandfather. I intend to have my children, my grandchildren, doting on me. But I am never home. I'm always on the road, working 18, 20. I never see my children. But I intend that when I'm old and I can no longer work, that they'll have affection for me and they'll come to me and they'll surround me. The intention will not get you there. The direction that you're going is that your children will begrudge you. They won't have any connection with you. They'll feel that you abandoned them, and they will not be there when you intend for them to be there. So direction determines destination. So Dhritarashtra thinks, oh, we can do all kinds of crimes. We can attempt murder. We can try to kidnap the Pandava's wife. We can try and burn them. We can try and brown them. We cheated them at dice. We sent them in exile. But everything's going to turn out in our favor. And Sanjaya is giving him chances. He's given him so many chances. Even Krishna went and tried to plead for peace. And Sanjaya is telling him, Madhava, 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 husband of the goddess of fortune, is on the side of the Pandavas. You're not going to win. And Dhritarashtra gets it, but he has this disconnect between intentions and directions. And then when he refers to the Arjuna and company as the Pandavas, he indicates a very, very close family and friendly relationship with Krishna. Arjuna is a Pandava and he has a very, very close relationship with Krishna. And so Krishna is going to protect his family members. Right now in the next verse, the 15th verse of the first chapter, Sanjaya refers to Krishna by another name, Rishikesha. The verse is, Rishikesha blew his conch shell called Panchajanya, and Dhananjaya blew his, the Devadatta. So Rishikesha refers to Krishna and Dhananjaya refers to Arjuna. Rishikesha means the controller of the senses. The controller of the senses. Now, again, Sanjaya is trying to tell Dhritarashtra, trying to tell him, God is driving the chariot of Arjuna. And Arjuna is a great, great warrior. But he's going to have supernatural powers. You think Arjuna has been a great warrior up to this point. Now he's fighting and Rishikesh is his friend and his chariot driver. So there isn't going to be any limit to his powers now. Because Krishna has taken over his senses and he will be invulnerable. Nobody can defeat him. Now, on a mundane level, there were a few warriors that could probably, on a good day, if Arjuna had a bad day and they had a good day, they could probably defeat and even kill Arjuna. They were Dronacharya, Bhisma, and Karna. These three were generally considered to be the equals and maybe even the betters of Arjuna. But Sanjaya is saying, all that's off the table now because Krishna is protecting Arjuna. Rishikesha, he is the master of the senses, and Arjuna is surrendered to Krishna. So he's going to get power. He's going to get power. So maybe if you don't bounce out of bed in the morning, you don't see a good reason to get up, and you don't have zest and vigor, and you don't have purpose for your day, maybe you should think in terms of accessing more power. Maybe the power that you're relying upon is really just too puny and too insignificant. And maybe your energies are not properly focused and channeled. But Arjuna's focus was on Krishna. And Krishna is omnipotent. Krishna is the Lord descended on earth. And so Arjuna is going to access. He's going to be an instrument of the all-powerful Lord. So again, another indication from Sanjaya to Dhritarashtra, that the good guys are going to win. And then he refers to Dhananjaya. Dhananjaya, Dhan means wealth, and Jaya means victory. So Arjuna is famous as Dhananjaya, which means the winner of wealth. Arjuna has fought many, 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 many battles in the past. So that person who has surrendered to Krishna and who Krishna is using for his instrument is a tempered, heroic, celebrated, capable warrior. And now he's gone over the top with Krishna's power. It's also interesting to note that Arjuna had Hanuman on his flag. He flew a flag and all the soldiers had their own symbols, whatever it was, on the flag. But what was on the flag of Arjuna was not just a symbol of Hanuman. in another encounter in the Mahabharata, it's described that Hanuman promised that he personally would be on the flag of Arjuna, directing him in battle. And although Hanuman wasn't fighting, just like Krishna wasn't fighting, Hanuman said that from the flag, I will roar at certain critical moments in the battlefield. I will roar so loudly that your opponents will be unnerved, and then you'll take advantage of their distraction to kill them. Now, what's this? Five verses later, another name for Krishna from Sanjaya, Achyuta. Achyuta means infallible. Arjuna says, "O Achyuta, please drive my chariot between the two armies." So Krishna is Achyuta, he's the infallible Lord, and yet he has assumed the menial task of a chariot driver. And Arjuna is not forgetful. It's not that because Krishna has taken the role of his chariot driver that Arjuna is starting to think the less of Krishna. He's prefacing his remarks. They're about to go into battle. Arjuna is going to be snapping out orders, left, right, fast, forward. But he just wants Krishna to know that even though battle dictates this kind of snappishness, and I can't bow down and say prayers and then say, please turn right, you know, it's going to get, the pace is going to pick up. But I just want to tell you in the beginning that I acknowledge, I appreciate that you are Achyuta, that you're the all-powerful, infallible Lord, and you have wonderfully and kindly agreed to drive my chariot. It's also understood that as a chariot driver, he's going to be perfect. He's going to be infallible. He'll drive Arjuna's chariot in such an expert way that the animal would be baffled by their complicated maneuvers. And it'll be a very hard target. Arjuna will be a very hard target to hit because of Krishna's dexterity in manipulating the reins and the horses in the chariot. So the example is given of a judge and a grandson, of a judge as he relates to the criminals and as he relates to his grandson. All day long during work, the judge sits on a bench and he scowls and he's dealing with all kinds of criminals. And it's very important that the judge assume a higher, unassailable position. It's very important that the criminals feel intimidation and reverence towards the judge. That's the whole principle. So if you've ever been in court, you'll know there's a big... And the more serious the crime is, the more the courtroom is elaborate and there's flags there and the judge is high up and he's got a big wooden thing and there's carvings and he's got policemen and the judge may even have a 45 underneath his robes. And the whole thing is like, you have done wrong and you are not supposed to feel comfortable here. We don't want to see you here again. And you will be punished. And the next time you show up, you'll be punished. The law has to cast that demeanor. So Krishna is God, and one way or another, he causes to reap the results of our actions and bring punishment upon ourselves. But using the example of the judge himself, when the day is over, he'll take off his robes, and maybe underneath his robes there might be a pair of shorts and a banana public shirt, you know, and a Hawaiian shirt. And maybe he goes to a comedy club. You know, if he's single, maybe he goes to a comedy club and does stand-up comedy. Or if he has a grandson, he might go visit his grandson. And they start rolling in the grass and playing with each other. And in the course of that, the judge lowers himself. He doesn't play with his grandson, and I'm a 200-pound, 6-foot judge, and you're just a little squirt. And so he doesn't, like, knock his grandson all over the yard, you know, taking advantage of his size. Because the love is there. Because love is there, he gets down on his knees, same level as the grandson. And first he goes on an equal level. And then if there's some little fun, you know, some little wrestling, he'll allow the grandson to beat him. He'll allow the grandson to appear as if he was stronger than the grandfather. And that delights the grandson. He just giggles and laughs. And it delights the grandfather as well. So Krishna is God, but because of the love and lack of envy of his devotee Arjuna, he has voluntarily come down to drive the chariot of Arjuna. And Arjuna enjoys that. I mean, wouldn't you enjoy having God as your chariot driver, you know? And Krishna enjoys it too. He actually enjoys becoming subordinate to his pure devotees. He's called Bhakta Vatsal. Bhakta Vatsal. Vatsa means chest. And the word ale means protection. Let's see, bhakta vatsal, who brings the devotees near him and gives them protection. Actually, it literally means who gives them warmth. And if you look over there at that picture on the wall, it's the picture of Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. And what happened was Indra caused a huge rainfall to descend upon Vrindavan, the village of Krishna. And the rainfall was so stringent that it threatened to drown all the cows and all the inhabitants of Vrindavan. So Krishna counteracted the rainfall by lifting Govardhan Hill on the little finger of his left hand and holding it as an umbrella. Then he invited everyone to come in and out of the rain and under the shelter and protection of the mountain, which acted like an umbrella. And they could even crowd up next to Krishna and enjoy the warmth of Krishna's body. And in the same way, Krishna is called Bhakta Vatsala, who brings the devotees near him and gives them protection. Once again, I don't have a number besides this because this is a repetition of the name Rishikesh again. I'm not sure what verse this is. It's not noted here on the slide. But Sanjaya again is describing to Dhritarashtra, and he says, O Bharat, that means Dhritarashtra, having been thus addressed by Gudakesha, the Lord Rishikesha drew the chariot between the two armies. So Rishikesha means controls all the senses of the living beings. And in the previous verse, the use of the word Rishikesh was that Krishna is going to take over the senses of Arjuna and he's going to become indomitable. Now in this sense, it more means like Krishna, again, following the verse where Krishna is described as a chariot driver, then the word Rishikesh here indicates that Krishna is coming under the control of one of Arjuna's senses. Krishna is the controller of all the senses, but he's voluntarily subordinating himself to Arjuna. So now Krishna has come under the control, or allowed himself to come under the control of one of Arjuna's senses. And which one is that? Speech, right, speech. As I said, Arjuna is going to start controlling Krishna by his speech. Drive fast, slow down, stop, hard right, hard left, circle, turn around, go back. So the Lord, who controls everybody, who's in everyone's hearts, as the super soul, the fact that I can hold up my hands and gesture is due to the sanction of Lord. I'm not doing this, I'm desiring it. And Krishna is actually fulfilling it. The fact that you just adjusted your glasses and now you're scratching your neck is because of Krishna's sanction, or we're yawning formally. That's all because of Krishna's sanction. We only wish it. I wish I could yawn. But if Krishna doesn't give you the nod, you can't even lift your hand to scratch your neck or open your mouth to yawn. There are many people who can't. There are many people who are physically challenged, I think is a political correct term nowadays. They send a signal, I want to scratch my neck. But there's no sanction there. So they can't scratch their necks. They can't tie their shoes. So every time we scratch our necks, we should give thanks that the Lord is allowing us to exercise our will. But he's actually doing everything. In spite of that, he's driving the chariot, responding to the orders that are barked out by Arjuna in the heat of battle. Now, Gaudakesh is a name that's used to refer to Arjuna here, and it means one who conquers sleep, and sleep is often compared to ignorance. Guda literally means molasses, and molasses is very sweet, as we all know. So Gaudakesh means one who has very, very sweet, sweet relationships with Krishna. That's Gaudakesha. And then Akesha breaks up. A stands for Vishnu, Ka stands for Brahma, and Isha stands for Shiva. All three of these come from Krishna. From Krishna comes Brahma, and from Brahma comes Shiva, and they all come from Krishna originally. So Krishna himself is controlled by the speech of Arjuna, and Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the great, three great gods of creation, preservation, they're coming from Krishna. So when you control Krishna by your love, you control Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva as well. Now here's the first time, as far as I know, in the Gita, that Krishna is referred to as Krishna, and we know that means all attractive. The verse here is in the 28th verse of the first chapter, where Arjuna addresses the Lord. He says, "O Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before me in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering and my mouth drying up." Seems like Arjuna is starting to lose his nerve here. He sees relatives, teachers, cousins, friends, and naturally there's a bit of paralysis that sets in. I mean, it's hard to aim a gun at someone you love or to shoot an arrow at someone you love. You know, imagine if you were playing darts and someone put a picture of your mom on the dartboard. You wouldn't want to throw the dart. What to speak if your mom was actually standing there? And it wouldn't matter if she was a bad person. She's still your mom, you know. So that's the problem. Arjuna, they're bad people. They've done bad. But, you know, it's paralyzing when you see the image of someone that you love in front of you. And so the meaning of Krishna in this connection is one who removes the faults of his devotees. What Arjuna is suffering from is a lack of perspective right here. He's not seeing the whole picture. He's seeing everything because of his bodily connection with his teacher and his cousins. What he doesn't see is that their sins have been so great that at the time of death, they would have to take their next verse in such a way as to suffer the results of many of their sinful reactions. They could not in this time, lifetime, atone for all the sins they've committed. So the arrangement of Krishna is that they're all going to die on the battlefield. They're going to be seeing Krishna at the time of death, and they're going to get free from all their sins because of the purificatory effects of seeing Krishna. So Arjuna is thinking, I won't fight, I'll let them live. But the problem is, the longer they live, the more they'll have to suffer for their sins in this life and in the next life. So Krishna is actually showing mercy upon the wrongdoers by bringing about their death on the battlefield so that in one fell stroke, they're relieved of all their sins and they get undeservedly, really, they get salvation right there on the battlefield. Naturally, there's some pain between them and salvation, but, you know, if you have cancer and you have a big tumor, there's going to be pain between you and being healthy, being free of the disease. You have to submit to anesthesia. Surgeon comes in with a knife. He plunges in your body and he cuts out the tumor. If you've contracted a tumor, there's no way to get out of that situation without paying the price of some pain. So these guys are sinful. And they're not going to come out the other end without a little bit of pain. But it's worth it. You know, it's worth it. That's why so many people get surgery, to have tumors removed. They're happy to do it. The pain is a small price to pay for being free from the disease. So that's what Arjuna is not seeing here. That's his fault. He only sees what's in front of his nose. He only sees the immediate. He only sees the bodily. He doesn't see what the long-range plan of Krishna really is. So I'll just cover this last name here. This is fifth name. I think there are 8 different names altogether in chapter 1. So we'll just cover the fifth one here and then call it quits because yoga is about to start. And I hear some people downstairs also. So in the 30th verse of the first chapter, we find here, it said, "O killer of the Kesi demon," this is Arjuna, "I am now unable to stand here any longer. I am forgetting myself and my mind is reeling. I see only misfortune." Again, short-term, seeing what's only immediate, Arjuna becomes disheartened, paralyzed. He doesn't see how any good can come from killing his kinsmen. Now here we have from Purushottam Das, as I mentioned, he compiled this book called The Names of Krishna, and then he consulted the commentaries of great saints in this regard. He referred to Vishwanath Chakravarti, Baladeva Vidyabhusa, and in this case, he's quoting Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who says the Keshi demon represents the mentality. Krishna was called Keshava. So the mentality of the Keshi demon is a prideful mentality. I am a great devotee. I am a great saint. I am entitled to opulences. So what Arjuna is doing in praying to Krishna here and in referring to him as Keshava is asking Keshava to remove his pride. Remove his pride. Because when you're prideful, you don't get wisdom. Wisdom is given only to the humble. And right now, Arjuna's a little prideful. He's talking to Krishna on a friendly basis, as if they were friends. And Krishna's kind of withholding. Krishna's being silent. He's not answering Arjuna's questions, because the tone of Arjuna is a bantering tone. It's a tone of equals almost, you know. Later on in the second chapter, after Arjuna puts aside his pride and then addresses Krishna as his teacher and describes himself as the shiksha, the student. See, Arjuna just talks and talks and talks and talks, and he can't get the resolution on his own. He finally, shortly after this, he talks himself out. He's out of energy, he drops his bow, he's quivering, and he's out of words. And then he gives it to Krishna, just like a child gives their problems to their father. And at that point, then Krishna responds. And he says, since you have asked me as a teacher, I will respond to you, and I will clear up your doubt, and I will dissipate those faults which are causing you to be emasculated and unmanned. So those are the first five different names by which Krishna is addressed as Arjuna. And there are 8 or 9 of them in the first chapter, and 40 of them altogether throughout the course of the Bhagavad Gita. So it'll probably be about a 3 or 4 session, or 3 or 4 segment series here.